Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 211 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and follow the instructions. Just remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. That also applies to PRN.FM's new voicemail. Call 862-800-6805, and as well as a message or question for the show, leave your name and indicate that the question is for us, the Infectious Myth. I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. Email, Twitter, Facebook, or voicemail. Or some other creative method if you can think of that. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. You can make a one-time donation to the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. I got an interesting email from Maria, who had earlier asked me to try to get former South African President Thabo Mbeki on the show. I did try via his foundation, but got no response. The reason to talk to him is that he was the only major politician to directly confront the AIDS establishment, and perhaps he doesn't want to go once more into the lion's den. Anyway, Maria wrote, "I really enjoyed listening to your recent interview with David Healy. It inspired me to remind myself of the great activities of Peter Gotchi and to look into the Cochrane Institute more closely. It was an excellent show. Keep up the good work." I had another idea. I'm an American living in New Zealand. Here, there is a poison used to kill rats, possums, and other small mammals that prey on native birds and other native New Zealand species called 1080. I certainly agree that native species deserve protection. The problem is that 1080 is a very dangerous poison. It is, in fact, not in use in most countries, and many totally ban it. Here in New Zealand, it's in common use, even with aerial drops. The country is very divided, but the government, no matter which party is in charge, supports using it. Worse, it actively labels all those who oppose it or even question it as nutcases and conspiracy theorists. But there's good reason why 1080 use should be at the very least restricted. It's not a left-right issue. Hunters oppose 1080 use. Deer hunting is very popular in rural New Zealand. And also SAFE, which is an animal rights organization. It's astonishing to me that a country like New Zealand that prides itself and markets itself as a bastion of environmentalism would use this despicable poison. I thought about it, and I'll certainly investigate that. I'm interested in issues where there are good points on both sides, but one side seems to be dominant, and the other side may have some important points or principles, but they're just completely squashed, so I need to look into it. Anyway, we have a great interview this week on a completely different subject, something that we haven't covered ever before, I don't think. But I was very pleased to be able to get Rabbi David Miviser on the show to discuss the charitable status of the Jewish National Fund. David Miviser is a retired rabbi currently living in Hamilton, Ontario, after having served synagogue congregations in Vancouver and Pennsylvania for over 20 years. He's lived in Israel for 4 years and has two adult children who live there now. He's an active member of Independent Jewish Voices in Canada and the Rabbinic Council of Jewish Voices for Peace in the United States. He's one of four Canadians who filed a formal complaint with the Canada Revenue Agency in October 2017, detailing how the Jewish National Fund Canada violates Canada's tax laws in five different ways and demanding that its charitable status be revoked. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much.
So let's start by talking about what is the Jewish National Fund. I understand they plant forests in Israel. That all sounds good. So what is the issue that you have with the Jewish National Fund?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for asking. I'm going to give a bit of a historical perspective. So if we go back 120 years to the end of the 19th century, millions of Jews lived in Eastern Europe and were very impoverished and very oppressed. There were pogroms, outbreaks of really organized violence that killed literally tens of thousands of Jews in the 1800s. And in the 1890s, the political Zionist movement came together saying that Jews should, like other people, have their own country. And the place to do that is our biblical homeland that we call the Land of Israel. And also at that time, it was called Palestine. So in that group around 1900, they did what I think was a really smart and in some ways very beautiful thing. They started a charity for people to donate money to that would buy plots of land in Palestine that then some Jews could go and live there. They had some place to go, some place to live.
Right.
And they called it the Jewish National Fund. And it started, like I said, around 1900 and raised money and bought plots of land. And it went on like that for several decades. And
right.
That as it grew, the leaders of it had the idea of just getting all the land. This is in their own documentation. You can find it in their diaries and in minutes of their meetings and so on. Little by little, they want it all.
So all the land of Palestine, but they were planning to buy it? Like, how were they going to get this land?
Well, that's a really good question. And I thought myself that it was all bought legitimately. There were landowners, sometimes there were huge holdings of land by absentee landowners that lived maybe in Istanbul or in Beirut, and they might
right.
have owned thousands and thousands of acres. And the JNF bought it from them, and then the tenant farmers who lived there got forced off their land. But it was all bought legitimately, nothing evil about that in particular.
It's just normal capitalism,
Yeah, well, not even capitalism in a way. Honestly, this was very collective, right?
Right.
It was owned on behalf of all the Jewish people everywhere. It wasn't privately owned.
No, but what I'm saying is that mm-hmm. in capitalism, you might live in an apartment building, and then the owner that you don't even know sells the apartment building to somebody else, and all of a sudden you're kicked out, and that's
right.
Probably illegal. Not maybe
right.
always ethical.
That's right. Anyway, that is what I believed happened until 1948. And I'll talk about 1948 in a minute. 1948 is when the British Mandate came to an end. And that's when a war broke out between Jews who lived there and Arabs or Palestinians who lived there, 1948.
Right.
So I always thought that until 1948, every bit of land that Jews got was just legitimately bought. It was fair and square.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were disadvantaged, unfortunately, but
right.
That's how it goes. But I read a book a few years ago that really changed my mind about that, called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by an Israeli professor of history named Ilan Pape. And I would recommend that to anybody who wants to learn more about this. So in that book, I learned that through the late 1930s and going into the 1940s, the leaders of the Jewish National Fund and other Jewish organizations developed plans to simply push out the Arabs from their villages. I'm answering your question about how was that planned. So until 1947, they couldn't do that. But starting in 1947, they actually did start to do that. And they used terror and violence, and they would, like, you know, drag some people out of their houses and kill them. And all the rest of the people in the village would flee, and they would take over this village. But I don't want to get too much into details. You asked, what is the Jewish right. National Fund? So I was saying it was started in the early 20th century to buy land collectively for Jews exclusively. Mm-hmm. And it did that. And then in 1948, in this war, Jews pushed Palestinians out of hundreds of villages, somewhere between 400 and 500 villages, out of entire cities like Haifa or Yafo or western part of Jerusalem. And then when the war was over, the Israeli government declared these places to be, they would have absentee owners. The owners were absentees. Mm-hmm. The Israeli government gave the JNF control of all these lands and properties, even urban properties, to manage as if they were doing it on behalf of the absentee owners. And there's kind of a legal fiction that when the absentee owners come back, oh, okay, you know, then the JNF will give it back to them. And then after a few years, when the absentee owners didn't come back because they couldn't, and those who even tried to sometimes were just shot and killed on site, then after a few years, the Israeli government gave that land to the JNF. So the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, since the early 50s, has either owned or controlled about 90% of the land in Israel. And it's just in their charter, it's their purpose, that it's exclusively for the use of Jews. So that's describing the JNF. I want to say a little bit more about it. So they do, you said, oh, they plant trees. Well, they have planted millions and millions and millions of trees.
Right.
And they've done other things like water projects and, you know, preparing land for agricultural use.
Right.
And some of that is a good thing. And some of that actually is done to hide the ruins of Palestinian villages. And some of it is simply environmentally or ecologically not what belongs there. You know, if you talk about making the desert bloom, which is one of their slogans,
right?
Perhaps the desert isn't supposed to bloom. It's a desert.
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of like growing cotton in California of, you know, bring water from afar.
That's
but
right.
That tends to create problems like salination, and after, you know, 50 years of irrigation, sometimes the land becomes unusable because of the salt accumulation.
That's the same thing's taking place there. There's a beautiful lake that is called the Sea of Galilee, mm-hmm. usually in English, in Hebrew it's called the Yam HaKinneret. It's beautiful, and the water has been taken from it, and it's shrinking, and there's, you know, anyway, that's a mess. Anyway, you get that idea. So to say that, they plant trees. This is called greenwashing.
Mm.
Like, so the JNF projects an image very successfully, persuading people that it's a big environmental organization and it makes the desert bloom and it plants forests. But when you look more closely, you see that a lot of the forests are monoculture, that are exotic species that wouldn't grow
right.
there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And a real issue that's very blatant, especially, I think, you know, you and I are both in Canada as we're speaking right now.
Right.
We're both Canadians. There's a project called Canada Park.
Uh-huh.
That I just like to talk about that for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So.
Mm-hmm. So I just said how in 1948, there was a war that resulted in the establishment of a Jewish state of Israel, and many, many, something like 750,000 Palestinian refugees, maybe 400 to 500 villages destroyed and so on. That was 1948. In 1967, there was another war, a very short one, in which Israel conquered the entire rest of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And also emptied out villages, completely just depopulated them, forced the people out at gunpoint. And there's three villages between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in a place that Israel didn't want Palestinians at all. Mm-hmm. And within days, Israel forced out all the people. Not a shot was fired. The people put up no resistance. No Israelis were hurt or killed. There was no military threat from these villages being there, but Israel wanted them gone. So it forced all the people out, and Jewish National Fund bulldozers bulldozed the villages. You can see photographs of bulldozers with the Jewish National Fund logo on them bulldozing these villages. So three villages were bulldozed, and then trees were planted on top of the ruins, literally the rubble. If you go there today, you can just see like building stones and even rebar and stuff sticking up out of the ground. And that was done with, I didn't get to this point yet, but tax deductible donations from Canada. Canadians donated millions of dollars to build this forest, this park, this very nice recreation area, right? If you only listen to the JNF, what you'll hear is, oh, we built this lovely park and it's got bike trails and water fountains and we plant flowers in it. And look at all these trees. Didn't used to be trees here. What a nice thing we did. Isn't this lovely?
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, but it's actually hiding the ruins of these three villages.
And what was the problem with those villages? They were just geographically located in a strategic area, and the Israeli government wanted them gone to exert total control over the area between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv?
Basically, yes. I could be very specific. Listeners who are familiar with the Christian Bible will know of a place called Emmaus.
Uh-huh.
Emmaus. I actually don't remember exactly what happened there, but Jesus did something there, you know.
Was so that one the of water to wine? That might have been the water to wine incident. I don't know my
We can look in it's in the book. But one of these villages was called Emmaus.
Emmaus.
Yeah. And they were in a little enclave, almost like a little finger poking out of the West Bank and into what was Israel between 1948 and 1967. So you might imagine, I mean, you can look on a map, but you might imagine that there was a kind of a, it was like a boundary or a border. It actually was just a ceasefire line. It never got turned into a border. But there was this one little place where in 48, the Israelis didn't succeed in pushing out the Arabs and taking their village. And it was sticking into Israel. And they didn't want that there. So throughout the West Bank, I don't think Israel just demolished villages, right? But these three were kind of sticking into Israel. And they didn't want them there. So they demolished them.
So they were totally gone.
I just want to bring it back to this point. So it was the JNF that demolished over 1,000 homes, schools, stores, mosques, churches, you know, and then put this park, and they call it Canada Park. And if you were to go there today, you'd see plaques, actually municipalities in Canada, public money. Canadian public money was given to the JNF to build Canada Park.
Because to erase the JNF.
It totally does. And then I'm jumping around a little bit.
Right.
I'm gonna make a big jump here, and we can fill in details later. But in the introduction to me, you said I was one of four Canadians who filed a formal complaint with the Canada Revenue Agency in October 2017 because the JNF is violating Canadian tax law and should have its charitable status revoked. So another one of the four beside myself is a retired doctor in Halifax named Ismail Zaid.
Mm-hmm.
And he was born in one of these villages called Beit Nuba. And he lived there until he was like a teenager.
Uh-huh.
He remembers this, like what I'm talking to you about. You know, it might sound like long ago and far away, but it's this man's life.
Right.
And he told me that his uncle was in one of these houses when it was bulldozed and was killed. And his entire village was literally wiped off the face of the earth.
And so his memories, people have fond memories of their childhood, of course. Their fields or forests or whatever was around that they like. And there's something about losing that, knowing that you cannot go back to the town you were born in and see where you were born, because it's all completely
gone. It's not there.
Gone.
Right. So again, the issue, I mean, there's a big justice issue, human rights issue. You know, what should be, how should humans live in this world with other humans? That's a big issue, but we can bring it down also to, this is done with tax-deductible donations from Canadians giving to this organization to finance this stuff.
Right.
That's very specifically why we filed this complaint.
Okay, so I want to get to that, but a couple of things you said that I had no idea before. The first is that this organization, JNF, owns 90% of the land in Israel, and I presume it's a non-profit organization, so it's not like a corporation, but it's also not government. And secondly, that they have a specific mandate to provide land to Jews and not to anybody else.
Exactly.
So who runs the JNF? Like, it seems
hold on before we get there. I want to be very accurate. I don't want to have something said that isn't accurate and true.
Okay.
So the JNF doesn't own 90% of the land. Instead, it controls it.
Oh, controls. Okay. Yes.
Right. So the JNF outright owns, depending what sources you read, either 13 or 16% of the land in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say that, we're talking about what we call inside the green line, inside the pre-67 ceasefire line.
Right.
So the JNF doesn't own land in what we call the West Bank or the occupied Palestinian territories, but it does control 90% of the land within Israel. And the remaining 10% is either government land or private land.
And by Israel, I mean that itself is which boundaries are you talking about when you refer to Israel?
Right. Well, actually, Israel's never established its boundaries. And Israel has, since 67, tried to erase that green line that separated it from the West Bank. If you get maps, it won't be on a map. Or if you actually go there, you don't see a sign saying, oh, now you're crossing this line. They try to just blur it and erase it. But anyway, who controls it, right?
Right. Well, first of all, does the 90% refer to within the green line, the original boundaries of Israel, or does it also incorporate the West Bank?
No. Just within what you call the original boundaries of Israel inside the green line. Yeah.
Okay. So who controls the JNF? I think it's important.
Yeah. So there's a board, and it's very political, and there's a board, there's a chair, there's an executive director. It's public. I mean, you can go on a website and find this out. It's very political. The JNF in Israel owns like either 13 or 16% of the land. It's worth tens of billions of dollars. When you think charity, and you said it's not a corporation, it's not a for-profit corporation, the land that it owns and the properties that it owns are worth tens of billions of dollars. And lately in Israel, it's become very controversial where the Israeli government wants to shut it down. The Israeli government itself wants to take away the JNF's tax-exempt status in Israel.
Interesting.
And just last year, this was a major issue. And the government was going to take away its tax-exempt status, and they reached a deal where the JNF in Israel is going to give the Israeli government something like 3 billion shekels, which is about three-quarters of a billion Canadian dollars or half a billion American dollars annually in lieu of paying taxes, and able to then keep its own like autonomous status, so that it doesn't have to give up control over its properties.
So what does it do with all the money that it's gathering? I mean, it doesn't have shareholders, so what's happening to all of this money? Is it just accumulating it, or is it buying more land, or what does it do with all the money it brings in?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is developing not, I don't know about buying land, but developing, you know, building buildings.
Right.
And it also, I'd like to be honest, it provides a lot of money for social services. Like it funds rehabilitation for wounded veterans.
Right.
It funds computer training for youth at risk, actually, so they can become more productive and have jobs. It
right.
funds women's shelters. It builds playgrounds in disadvantaged neighborhoods. So the JNF, again, it does good things. It's not like thoroughly the epitome of evil.
Are all these programs limited to Jews or?
No, the land that they own cannot be leased or sold to anybody but a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
The social service things are open to people that need these services. And also, again, just to be honest, I mean, we have to be truthful, right? The parks are open to anybody. They don't have somebody
right.
at the gate of the park keeping out Palestinians. Palestinians
right.
can go in there and picnic. They might be picnicking on the rubble of their grandparents' house,
mm-hmm.
but they are allowed, certainly. It's for everyone.
Right.
But I just you asked, so what do they do with the money? So it's kind of like a self-perpetuating bureaucracy,
uh-huh.
right? And it doesn't want to say like, oh, okay, we fulfilled our goal back there in 1948, and now we got the land, and the JNF can go out of business now and let the government manage the land. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
want to do that. It just keeps itself going. So it has developed hundreds of social service programs. It runs things like bird sanctuaries. It builds bike trails.
Right.
And it also builds security roads, like along the edge of Gaza. They plant trees, which sounds really nice, but they plant
mm-hmm.
trees in a way that provides security for Israeli military driving up and down the, you know, the fence with Gaza to give them more cover. So it does all kinds of things like that. I just want to mention something else for any Canadian
yeah.
listeners. So in order to have charitable status, a charity has to state what its charitable purpose is.
Uh-huh.
And the JNF has never done that, right? So in this conversation, I said, well, it was founded to acquire land for Jews to be able to live in the land of Israel. Nice.
Uh-huh.
And now we're hearing, oh, but it also funds women's shelters, rehabilitation for wounded soldiers, computer training for, you know, youth at risk. So what is the purpose of this organization, right? It's never established that. And that in itself is a violation of Canadian tax law.
Right. I mean, some of those things sound charitable, but you're mentioning things that overlap with the Israeli military. So I assume
exactly.
that's one of your concerns. So what are some of the other
exactly.
things that the JNF is doing that assist or cooperate with the Israeli military?
Well, actually, they have built facilities inside Israeli military bases in the West Bank, in the occupied Palestinian territories, which itself is a violation of international law that
uh-huh.
Canada is obliged to uphold. Canada has signed this law. So they've built facilities inside military bases for just things like exercise rooms or gyms
uh-huh.
or you know, lounges for soldiers to, you know, help their mental health or things like that. They
right.
say, this was pointed out to the CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, that the JNF was violating Canadian tax law in that way.
Uh-huh.
That was just, we pointed that out in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And the JNF responded by saying like, oh, we stopped that. After 2016, we don't do that anymore. So I believe they don't any longer build facilities inside military bases,
mm-hmm.
but they do fund programs in cooperation with the military. I just mentioned a couple of them.
Well, okay, so we got the roads, the trees by the roads
yeah.
On the border of Gaza. So others?
They do training programs for what they call youth at risk and computer skills explicitly, so that when they enlist in the military, they can become military engineers or work in computers in the military. And they actually do this to get, it's coordinated with the military.
Okay, I mean, recently I read an article that Canada did revoke funding for another Israeli-linked charitable organization named Beth Eloth. And one of the things this article said was that Beth Eloth funded programs called Mechanot that prepare Israeli high school students for military conscription, and which includes weapons training, mentoring by Israeli soldiers, and visits to army bases.
Yes, this was done with tax-deductible donations from Canada.
And so it sounds like, following the logic of what Canada did to Beth Eloth, it should be a no-brainer to revoke the charitable funding for JNF. But somehow, when these organizations get big enough, the sort of the laws adapt to these big, powerful organizations, as opposed to the law being applied equally.
Yeah. So the JNF invests tremendously in political protection. The JNF in the US and also in Canada, and it operates in other countries. It operates in England and South Africa and Australia. Mm-hmm. But it invests a lot in cultivating political relationships. So most large cities have like a big fundraising dinner, and it'll honor the governor or honor the mayor, or it'll honor Stephen Harper, you know, or John Baird, you know, us Canadians know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, prime minister. The JNF, when Stephen Harper was our conservative prime minister for all those years, it started a thing called the Stephen Harper Bird Sanctuary, which they haven't even built yet, but Stephen Harper feels good about that, right?
Right.
I'm just saying the JNF invests a lot in what I just called political protection in the U.S. and in Canada. Those are the places I know. So it also invests a lot in promoting this image of an environmental organization. It does so many good things for socially disadvantaged people. Like I said, it actually funds women's shelters for battered women. Who could oppose that?
Yes. You know,
it provides equipment for disabled children. Oh, what a nice and good thing that is. Right. So the JNF creates this image as being really good. Whereas Beth Eloth was a completely shadowy, unknown organization. Mm-hmm. I never heard of it until the story broke.
Right.
That their tax exempt their charitable status was revoked. And I just want to point out that Beth Eloth last year sent $61 million to Israel, and the JNF in Canada sent $30 million. So Beth Eloth somehow raised twice as much money. It did not have a website. It doesn't have a website. It never had a website. It has no staff people. Its entire administrative expenses reported to the CRA was something like $30,000 a year, and it raised and gave $61 million a year, right? So I'm saying it flew under the radar.
Yes.
It had no political protection. It basically was run out of like one person's apartment somewhere in Toronto. It probably, I'm saying this now, I hope I don't get accused of libel, but it probably was just a way for some, you know, oligarchs to money launder, or I don't know what, is a very shadowy, unknown, hidden thing. I'm contrasting that to the JNF, which is very public.
Right. So totally different strategies.
It's very hard for the CRA politically. It's very hard for the CRA to take away the JNF's charitable status. There would be such a hue and cry. The members of parliament have been board members of the JNF, right? I'll just jump to something else. So we, in Canada, we launched a formal legal parliamentary petition for Canadian citizens and legal residents of Canada to sign, which will go to the Minister of National Revenue, demanding that she do an audit of the JNF. Mm-hmm. Is it violating Canadian tax law? The answer is yes. If it is, revoke the charitable status. And that petition is online, and any Canadian can sign it. And by law in Canada, it will be presented in Parliament, probably in May. It's open for signatures until May 9th. So okay. It'll be presented in Parliament in May, and our Canadian government is obliged to respond to it. It doesn't mean they're going to do what we ask them to do, but they will right. have to respond.
Well,
Minister of National Revenue will have to say, what are they doing about this? And that right. helps us build a case.
My observation of both the United States and Canada is that the governments have been pretty much in lockstep with the interests of the state of Israel. Canada has also supported the Palestinians to some extent, but I think with the new Prime Minister Trudeau and also with Harper, there was yeah. a stronger and stronger alignment with Israeli government policy. But I think there are some cracks showing. Yeah. For example, in the United States now, there are a handful of politicians who are right. not following the Israeli party line. That and means. Recently in Canada, the Green Party slightly supported BDS. So maybe we can talk about BDS, because this is another...
Yeah. Before we do that, David, could yep. I mention how people can sign this petition?
Sure, and I'll put a link on the show notes so people can...
Good, okay, all right. So, okay, well, let me just say it. So please, anybody who wants to learn more and consider signing it, go to www.stopthejnf.ca. And you okay. can read about it, and there's a link to this petition. And if you're so moved, sign the petition, and that will go right into Parliament in a few months. And it closes okay. on May 9th. That's it, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, people have lots of time to sign. Do you have to be a Canadian to sign it, I assume?
Yeah, either Canadian citizen or a resident of Canada.
Right. But I mean, there's lots of, if you're American.
I'll just say there's other good reasons to move to Canada too.
Yes. There's lots of those. Not the weather, at least not right at,
not right at the moment.
But yes, there's lots of good reasons to be in Canada. So let's talk about BDS and also the fact that you're Jewish. And you know, in the past, there was a lot of pressure for all Jews to align with the state of Israel. And again, mm-hmm. that is cracking. And you mentioned mm-hmm. BDS. So can you describe mm-hmm. what BDS is and what parts yeah. of it you support?
Yes. Well, actually, I used to align with the state of Israel. I did. Mm-hmm. So I just my kind of the trajectory of my personal life somehow reflects what you're talking about. When I was mm-hmm. a teen, like in the 1960s, I thought, that's where I belong. Right? That's my homeland. Right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wasn't born there, but that was just an accident of history that I wasn't. I belong there. And I right. went there and I lived there. And, you know, during the course of decades, I started seeing more and more clearly what was going on. And it was very difficult for me to let go of the ideals, or you can even call them myths, images, legends, whatever visions that I had so attached myself to. It's very hard for me and other people to kind of let go of those things and reorient ourselves. But that is happening. So yes. So BDS is like a tactic or a strategy that was mm-hmm. initiated by Palestinians something like 12 years ago. Something like 150 different Palestinian civil society organizations like labor unions, student organizations, women's groups, even municipalities together recognized that they need support from around the world. And they're talking about nonviolent support. And they asked people around the world to boycott certain things from Israel, not everything. It's not a blanket boycott of Israel, but it's a boycott mm-hmm. of businesses and entities in Israel that either exploit or profit from the occupation of the West Bank. That's the B. The D is divestment, and that's probably clear, to stop investing and pull out investments from, again, businesses and other entities that benefit and control, make life miserable for people in the West Bank. And then mm-hmm. the S is sanctions to block Israel from certain things, like from participating in sporting events or, like in the Eurovision Song Contest, or like sanctions. And this was part of what made a big difference in South Africa.
Uh-huh.
So Palestinians are asking us to do this. And I think that's a very powerful call. And I feel really obliged to do that. It's having some effect. I mean, the Israeli government is actually so scared of it. They've allocated tens of millions of dollars to an agency that its whole goal is to combat BDS. They wouldn't do that if BDS wasn't effective.
Right. Another observation I've made is that there's been a big shift amongst Palestinians from a strategy of violence to one of more nonviolent civil disobedience, you might call it. I mean, everybody remembers the horrible attack at the Olympics in Munich in the 1970s. That was, an example of the extreme violence, which I think just backfired because Palestinians were seen as awful, evil people who deserved to be wiped off the face of the earth.
It was certainly spun that way. Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, I think it was a huge tactical error to go to violence against athletes who can't bear the entire weight of government policy. You know, even if the government policy is wrong, those attacks, they end up killing people who aren't the architects of the policy. So there definitely that's been a big shift. And another shift I think I've seen, and maybe you can tell me, is that support for Israel and Zionism, I think, has shifted from the left to the right. And we now have fundamentalist Christians and Republicans who are the strongest supporters of the status quo.
Yes, you're exactly right. Something that was very encouraging last week is that in the U.S. Senate, a bill was introduced which would essentially criminalize BDS.
Uh-huh.
And it was heavily promoted by the people you just said, Republicans, and these so-called Christians, and also the Zionist lobby, especially AIPAC.
Mm-hmm.
And the encouraging thing was that something like 23 Democratic senators voted against it, which would not have happened even a few years ago.
Right.
Among those 23 Democratic senators who voted against it, all of the potential presidential candidates in the Senate voted against it. Of course, Bernie Sanders, but also Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, these people who, up until very recently, they would have just lined up with the Zionist lobby. But now they're stepping away from it. And the one who voted for it was Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
She voted for it, but she actually felt the need to make a statement saying she disagreed with that provision. She doesn't, she supports Americans' freedom to boycott, but the bill as a whole was a good one, so she voted for it. But I think that's a sign that the lockhold, just almost like just control that Israel's agents in America and Canada have had over the political process in these countries is starting to break up. And it's gone farther in the States than it has in Canada. That's something that, we here need to work on to shift things here. You mentioned the Green Party, which is tiny,
right?
But it's there. The NDP had the New Democratic Party in Canada had a very, very hot debate in its last convention around Israel, but to even have the debate was something.
Right.
So there's movement, and people can contribute to it in many ways. Everyone listening who cares about this can you know, kind of feed into that process and bring this movement about faster.
Yes. Another battleground over what's called free speech and anti-Semitism, which have multiple definitions, which happen to be pretty important, I think, is on university campuses. There, you were just mentioning some Canadian money from some wealthy people in Canada going to university campuses to help combat what they called anti-Semitism, which is really BDS. So what is this battle on campuses, and like, how does this terminology, you know, what is anti-Semitism according to yourself versus, say, AIPAC or some other pro-Israeli organization?
Well, false accusations of anti-Semitism are a weapon of mass distraction.
Yes.
It's a way to take people's attention away from the issue. The issue is Israeli oppression of Palestinians. It's actually brutal, violent, generations-long oppression. That's the issue. So I get accused of being anti-Semitic, which is like bizarre.
But the,
it's a tactic to shift the discourse and make us stop thinking about the real problem. So real anti-Semitism exists. And in fact, I would say it does seem to be growing, just like Islamophobia and racism against other visible minorities and marginalized groups and so on. In the last few years, I think since the election of Trump, these things have kind of crawled out from under the rocks. They're there. But it's interesting that the very organizations that seem to talk the most about you know, support for justice for Palestinians as anti-Semitic don't really do much about the really dangerous anti-Semitism on the right.
Well, that's an irony that on the right in America, there's a lot of anti-Semitism. It's always been there. And yet they're also, the right is also the strongest supporter for the state of Israel. Like there seems to be some tensions or contradictions there.
Yeah. Yes. It's even more so in Europe, where there's like just blatantly anti-Semitic political parties, like in Hungary, that are strongly supported by Israel. The fact that they're anti-Semitic, I don't think can be disputed. But what's going on, I think, is a kind of a worldview or a modus operandi of domination, forcefulness, militarism, you know, putting down minorities like Israel does so successfully. So they're called nationalists, you know, in Europe, admire what Israel's doing. And the same thing with white nationalists in America.
I mean, do you think that there's nirvana of the white supremacists in Europe is that, you know, we'll send the Africans back to Africa, we'll send the Jews to Israel, and, you know, we'll work with Israel to make Europe completely white again? I mean, is that kind of what they're thinking? Or maybe I can't really ask you what they're thinking, but it seems crazy that they would be so tightly linked to the state of Israel and at the same time have very strong anti-Semitic statements, truly anti-Semitic.
Yeah, well, it's
anti-Jewish.
It's not that they love the state of Israel. I think they love that Netanyahu and people like him, Avigdor Lieberman and Ayelet Shaked and others are so militant and so forceful, right? They've built such a huge military. They rule over people, right? They attack neighboring countries with impunity, right? It's not like they love the Jews. I think they love that way of being a country.
Right. They love, you know, bullies look up to other bullies. Yeah. But I mean, Israel has not accomplished its military objectives through its own money. I mean, there's been huge amounts of money from the United States. I don't know if Canada has supported it in a significant way, but there's massive amounts of money flowing to the Israeli military from the United States.
Yes. Well, that, all the more reason to admire them, right? They don't even have to pay for it themselves. Right? They're getting, you know, they're getting another country to support that.
Yes.
In this bill that I just mentioned in the Senate, it is a legislated commitment to $38 billion in military aid to Israel over the next 10 years. $38 billion in military aid to a country that has a standard of living like most kind of comfortable, wealthy Western and Northern European countries. Right? It's not a poor country. Yet it's the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid.
One of the other ironies I've found, and for a long time I didn't really think about it, but Israel is often referred to as a Jewish state, but most modern countries have moved towards a secular government, allowing multiple religions, equality under the law. So in Canada, you can have a mosque, you can have a synagogue, you can have a church, you can have a Buddhist temple, whatever. The government is religiously neutral, is non-religious secular government. I mean, I don't see a solution in Israel unless Israel becomes a modern secular state, which would mean that Jews and Christians and Muslims and atheists would have equality under the law, which is not the case today. Do you agree with that?
You know, I think that's a big picture of what you said. Yes, I agree. And then it's actually not that simple. So
let me it never
unpack,
is.
I can unpack that a little bit.
Yes.
So when you say, or anyone says, a Jewish state, first I want to say it's not a state actually that has the qualities of Judaism. Judaism is really about peace and justice, right? Mm-hmm. It says right in our Torah, seek peace and pursue it. Justice, justice, thou shalt pursue. And our rabbis in ancient times said of all the commandments of God, our religion counts 613 commandments of God, there's only two of them that use the word pursue. The rest of them, you need to do it when the opportunity comes. Let's just say about the Sabbath, when the Friday is coming to an end, it's going to be the Sabbath. Okay, keep a Sabbath, right? But pursuing is peace and justice. I would say that's a Jewish state. So this is more like a state of the Jews, a state for Jews. It's not a Jewish state, actually. That's the thing. That's just a cute, clever thing that I can say, which is true.
No, I think it's an important point.
Yeah, so it is an ethnic national state of the Jews. And as long as Israel remains a state of the Jews, then everyone else there will be disadvantaged. And there will constantly be frictions and tensions. And many of us, and more of us, believe the real solution is one single state with equality and justice and safety and freedom for everyone who lives there.
And respect for those things that people on the right love, like property rights, so that somebody who owned land would still have the right to that land, despite the fact that their family was evicted violently in 1948.
Yeah, could be. I mean, to me, that's actually a little different question. A Jewish state versus a state of everyone who lives in it, which is like, okay, I just wanted to say that. And then actually, some of what you said in your question, your preface, should be a little more examined. Like the law in Israel, even the Declaration of Independence of Israel, the actual law, it does give equality. There are something like 9 religions recognized by the state of Israel. I don't remember if it's 9 or 7. So that there are mosques, there are churches, there are Sunni mosques, Shiite mosques, Orthodox churches, Catholic churches, Protestant churches. There are Baha'is, there are people called Circassians. I wouldn't say it's as much a religious issue as it is an ethnic or national issue. And just something else I think is worth saying out loud is Jews have been disempowered, persecuted,
Yes.
Not many years before I was born, 1/3 of all the Jews in the world were murdered intentionally with the intention of getting the rest of them.
Right.
Right. And that leaves, that has some effects. Right? So,
yes.
So I'm just saying is that when we're dealing with all this stuff, it's probably good to just remember, like, where are people coming from? What's motivating them? Why are they acting that way? What is going on here? It doesn't make any of it right, doesn't justify it. But it's a part of the picture that we can't just like leave out and not mention it.
No.
So a lot of Israel's like overbearing, you know, posture toward like everybody else is coming from a very deep sense of insecurity.
I understand.
You know, and that lack of safety in the whole world. And that is reinforced over and over again. There's a lot of indoctrination around that, but, you know, so I think most Israeli, like you and I, might have just said, "Oh yes, a state for everyone who lives there, right? That's the solution." But and there are Israelis who see it that way and agree with that, and there are organizations that are promoting that idea. Mm-hmm. But most Israelis are afraid to go there based on what they see of the world. You know, the history, and yes, also what they see happening right now. They're in a rough neighborhood,
right?
And they feel the need to just be sure they're always in control.
Yes, we're running out of time. I can't believe we've been talking so long. It's been fascinating. Would you like to wrap up with any last comments?
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I guess I could say a big thing, kind of, which is people that really care about this mm-hmm. should try to get involved with other people who also care about it and try to make a difference. And in the introduction, you mentioned that I'm active in Canada with Independent Jewish Voices. We have chapters across Canada. We're a Jewish organization. People that aren't Jews are welcome to get involved and support us, but we speak as Jews, among Jews. Mm-hmm. And in the United States, there's a great organization called Jewish Voice for Peace. So that's a thing. And also many other churches, labor unions, mm-hmm. student organizations are involved. So if people want to be involved, like, please, you know, do what you can. Every single little piece helps. And then the other thing, again, right now in Canada, we do have this petition going about mm-hmm. the JNF, and it will be reported to the Minister of National Revenue, and she will have to deal with it.
Okay.
So let's get more signatures on that.
Okay, so I will include those links in the show notes. And thank you so much for joining me today, David.
Yes, thank you very much for getting the word out about all this.
Okay, goodbye.
All right, you too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to episode 211 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @InfectiousMyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/InfectiousMyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.